Unfortunately, the Prime Minister refuses to talk with doctors about pay, and so have been forced to do this.
Junior doctors are asking for a 35% restoration, while their senior counterparts are asking for an above-inflation pay rise. In July, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak said there would be no more negotiations on pay and that the rise recommended by the so-called independent pay review body was final. Yet this, the doctors say, isn't just about pay. It's about the depressing state of the NHS. Junior doctor Arjun Singh fears for its future.
If you're having people waiting 12 hours in waiting rooms before they're seen by a doctor, if you're having people having heart attacks and strokes in A&E waiting rooms before they're seen, well, that is a system that has collapsed. And the reason that it has collapsed is in large part because we've not funded our workforce properly. We can't retain doctors. You can't have a hospital and an NHS if your doctors are leaving so frequently.
According to the British Medical Journal, 4 in 10 junior doctors in the UK plan to leave the NHS as soon as they can find another job, at home or abroad. But while the trench warfare continues, delayed appointments have reached the 1 million mark, with the NHS's waiting list already at an estimated 7.6 million.
If the government has any hope of these doctors giving up their industrial action anytime soon, then today's double doctor strike should be a sign that that is simply not going to happen.
With both sides digging in their heels, the strikes could continue into another crippling winter. And for patients on the long waiting list, that could potentially mean months of more misery. Saeed Pourreza, London.
Palestinians keep descending further into poverty and de-development under the Israeli occupation. In a report released on Monday, the World Bank said poverty rates are stubbornly high, as roughly one out of four Palestinians live below the poverty line. Palestinian non-governmental organizations say the poverty is more severe in Gaza.
In Gaza, the situation is more and more catastrophic comparing to the West Bank due to the blockade and wars for the 16 years. We have high deterioration on the humanitarian conditions, also on the economic standards. And due to this blockade, we have food insecurity.
They say that the Israeli occupation and blockade are the main culprits behind the increase in poverty among Palestinians. The Abu Ajwa family in Gaza's Zaytun neighborhood, where more than a dozen people reside. Their average daily income is only around $5 a day. The abject poverty has forced them to live in miserable conditions.
Look at my house. It is falling apart and we can't afford to fix it. You can't even imagine how hard it is for me or for my family. Our living conditions and those of many families here are disastrous. We can hardly afford to put food on the table. Poverty has taken its toll on us, and I don't see any improvement to our situation anytime soon.
The situation of the Abu Ajwa family is just a small example of how thousands of people live in the tiny territory. Most Gazans are impoverished and rely on handouts to survive as their incomes continue to dwindle. More than 2 million Palestinians in the Gaza Strip have been living under intensified access restrictions since 2007 and are largely isolated from the outside world.
The people who are in need for humanitarian assistance, 80% of the population, and most of them children, women, elders, who are in bad need for such assistance on time we are suffering from shortage of funding for humanitarian aid. This will lead for more deterioration in the humanitarian and socio-economic situation.
Daily life is a constant struggle for most Gazans because of the inhumane Israeli practices.
According to experts, the Israeli regime is responsible for the high poverty rate and the near collapse of Palestine's economy, as well as its isolation from the rest of the world. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
According to the EU's own official data, 74% of small and medium-sized businesses within the 27-country bloc cannot find skilled workers. At the same time, millions of young people are unemployed. EU Youth Affairs Ministers met on Monday and Tuesday to discuss the crisis.
I think it's very obvious that we have a generation of young people who have been living through crisis after crisis since 2008. The financial crisis, the COVID pandemic, and now they're going through the consequences of a war at the heart of Europe.
The neglect of young adults in the EU was acknowledged last week in the European Parliament.
8 million young people are neither in employment, nor in education, nor in training. 8 million. Their dreams put on hold, their lives on standby.
Youth ministers have agreed to coordinate efforts across the EU to try and fix broken education systems.
One in every six Europeans has mental health problems, not just young people, but also older people connected to loneliness and isolation. For example, every European with mental health issues has a right to access help mechanisms.
It's a right, but experts say help is often unavailable. Apparently, there's a need to prioritise funding.
We have debts and deficits, so the challenge really is how to reconcile this continuous pressure on public budgets, which health is placing, with the broader macroeconomic context.
It is being suggested that allowing young people to fall through the cracks while focusing all resources on the war in Ukraine threatens the future of the entire EU project. According to campaign groups advocating for the rights of young people, the inability of the political establishment in the EU to bring about job opportunities is translating into growing support for extreme anti-EU political parties. It's thought this disquiet will become clearly evident in 9 months from now, when a record number of Eurosceptic candidates are forecast to be successful during European Parliament elections. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
After years of negotiations, the European Commission has finally taken a position on the migrant issue, the harshest one. Brussels will, in fact, back the Italian far-right government's hardline stance on migration. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni has welcomed a 10-point plan on migrants presented by European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen in Lampedusa on Sunday.
I'm confident the issue of migration will be added to the agenda of the next EU summit in October. We must stop departures from Africa and swiftly deport those turned down for asylum. The future of Europe is at stake here.
Following a surge in migrant arrivals on Italy's shores, von der Leyen visited the southern island of Lampedusa on Sunday, where the situation has been tense since the start of the year, with thousands of migrants stranded in difficult conditions. Here, von der Leyen announced a new migrant action plan, which includes fighting trafficking, returning migrants to the countries of origin, and transferring migrants from Italy to other EU member states.
It is very important for me because irregular migration is a European challenge and it needs a European answer. So we are in this together.
Germany has promptly expressed its support for another proposal made by the European Commission President von der Leyen that concerns expanding air and naval surveillance of the European Union's external borders. Some experts are of the idea that such a measure would be against international maritime law, as EU ships would not be allowed to operate in territorial zones where only North African states have jurisdiction.
Air and naval surveillance of the Mediterranean by the EU would be equivalent to a warlike act. We all know what has happened to Libya after the French-led NATO attack there. All migrants' countries of origin must be involved in a more democratic process of handling the migrants. Also, von der Leyen's 10-point plan on migrants is full of inconsistencies.
Meanwhile, French Interior Minister Gérald Darmanin made a lightning visit to Italy on Monday. In an interview to a French radio, Darmanin said that France is willing to help Italy to secure its borders, but it will not take in any migrants from the island of Lampedusa. Max Civili, Rome.
Sports is one of the fields that has made significant progress after the victory of the Islamic Revolution in Iran, and today Iranian athletes shine in different international competitions. In terms of the number of medals, the 2012 Olympics in London was unprecedented for Iranians after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. Iran left London with a total of 13 medals, 7 gold, 5 silver and 1 bronze, finishing 12th in the overall medal standings. But undoubtedly, Iran's national wrestling team has always brought colorful medals back home.
And now, as the World Wrestling Championships is underway in Belgrade, Irwan has already won one gold medal in the freestyle category. Greco-Roman wrestlers are well prepared for the World Championships as well as the Asian Games due in China's Hangzhou City.
We are very much prepared for the Belgrade World Championships. All the teammates are at the peak of their preparedness. After the Belgrade Championships, we have the Asian Games in Hangzhou ahead. I'm very much motivated and hopeful.
I've been a member of the national team for about 8 years now. I have a number of world and Asian medals. I'm quite ready for the Belgrade competitions.
Our Greco-Roman wrestling team is at its utmost readiness for the World Championship in Belgrade. The Belgrade event is of great importance because the medalists will be given the ticket for the Olympic Games. We are very much hopeful about winning medals.
Iranian athletes and especially wrestlers practice hard to get prepared for securing top places at global competitions, despite all the limitations which are imposed against Irwan and Iranian national teams.
Also at junior level, Irwan's national wrestling team has a good record to the extent that back in early August 2023, Irwan's national junior Greco-Roman wrestling team ranked first in World Championships in Istanbul, winning one gold, one silver and two bronze medals. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
One month after reaching a deal mediated by Qatar, the U.S. and Iran each released five prisoners sought by the other. The five U.S. detainees left Tehran aboard a Qatari plane for Doha, en route to their country. All were arrested on charges of espionage and collaborating with foreign governments. The U.S. citizens freed include Siam Aknamazi, Emma Charghi, and Murad Tahbaz. The identities of the other two have not been disclosed. The five Iranian prisoners were identified as Mehrdad Moin Ansari, Kambiz Attar Kashani, Reza Sarhangpur Kofrani, Amin Hassanzadeh, and Kaveh Lutfullah Afrasiabi. They were held in American jails illegally under the pretext of violating U.S. sanctions.
After a successful teamwork, five innocent Iranians held in U.S. prisons were freed today. Two of them are on the way to Tehran via Doha. Iran's Human Rights Council is determined to uphold the rights of Iranian nationals abroad in cooperation with the executive and judiciary powers.
Tehran has repeatedly urged Washington to release innocent Iranian nationals who have been taken hostage on baseless charges of bypassing U.S. sanctions, decrying Washington for tying the humanitarian issue with other issues, including the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal.
I mean, this is a type of blackmailing, you know, this is kind of like mafia work, but, you know, within a government, and this is what the U.S. does, right? They arrest people, they put, unjust charges, they fabricate charges. And this is their way of trying to bully the Islamic Republic of Iran and weaken them. But the Islamic Republic of Iran, thankfully with their leadership and the supreme leader, they're not giving in and they're not bowing down and they're not being submissive and they're fighting for their rights.
A few minutes after the release of the prisoners, U.S. President Joe Biden slapped fresh sanctions on Iran, sending a message of continued enmity towards the Islamic Republic. The sanctions on Iran's intelligence ministry and former President Mahmoud Ahmadinejad were imposed over the alleged disappearance of Bob Levinson, a former FBI agent. Levinson reportedly visited Iran's southern Kish Island on March 2007. He later went missing and his whereabouts have remained unknown ever since. Tehran and Washington have many unresolved issues which lay barriers in their ties, such as the heavy unilateral sanctions imposed unjustly by the U.S. Iran has time and again expressed readiness to put aside differences and resolve issues via diplomatic ways, such as this case.
The health ministry in Gaza Strip says that the lives of hundreds of kidney failure patients are at risk due to lack of medicine and special chemicals needed for dialysis machines. Most kidney patients are hospitalized in the territory's biggest medical center, the Shifa Hospital. The hospital, just like other health facilities in Gaza, has been struggling with severe shortage of basic supplies for several years under the Israeli blockade. This has hit the patients with chronic diseases, including renal failure, the hardest, and children are no exception.
Kidney failure patients in Gaza Strip are amounting to 1,100. These patients, usually every one of them will make dialysis 3 times per week in different hospitals of Gaza Strip. Among those 1,100, we have 38 children. So without having those dialysis every week 3 times, they will certainly succumb to their life and they will die.
The lives of kidney failure patients depend on dialysis machines, but they usually malfunction due to overuse and lack of spare parts for repairs.
I need kidney dialysis 3 times a week, and I suffer from various illnesses. Dozens of medicines are nowhere to be found in Gaza's hospitals. The situation is very dangerous, and not having the treatment is a death sentence to kidney patients.
Death and suffering for Palestinians have always been what has come out of Israel's policy of keeping almost every necessity under scarcity in the Gaza Strip. And the health system has been no exception.
Today, this crisis is very acute now. I think this is the top urgent crisis we're facing in Gaza Strip today. And as you know, every now and then, the Israelis are still waving to attack Gaza once again. So the situation is very hard, complicated. And humanitarian issues, including health sector, should be avoided from all those punishment to the Palestinian people because the patients will pay their lives.
What makes things worse for Palestinians is the fact that the international community remain apathetic to their plight.
Gazans have been facing difficulties in receiving medical care since 2007. The Ministry of Health blames the Israeli blockade for the endless suffering, especially among chronically ill patients. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. IRIB English Radio. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en.
As temperatures soar, Palestinian detainees in the Zionist regime jails live in oven-like prison cells with no available means to cool off. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the past 5 years of sweltering summers remind Yaqub Abu Asab of the Israeli regime prisons where he spent 15 years of his life. For Palestinian detainees, the hot season is itself a prison within a prison. The Zionist regime's restrictive measures compound the woes of prisoners made to suffer through yearly heat waves in prisons located in the desert or near hot, humid valleys that make life unbearable, the 51-year-old former detainee told Middle East Eye. Abu Asab spent his last sentence of 6 years in Gilboa and Megiddo prisons in northern occupied Palestine, where he says the heat waves get more severe every year. In the Israeli regime prisons, detainees regularly experience shortness of breath and general discomfort due to the absence of cooling systems and small, overcrowded prison cells, which in some prisons hold up to 8 detainees. The Zionist regime's prisons are built with concrete, which retains heat and lack proper ventilation. Meanwhile, some cells have no windows. Some are located underground, while others have single windows overlooking enclosed areas that don't let the breeze circulate. Abu Asab said, inside the cell, the prisoners try to reduce the heat themselves, so they are forced to shower at least 5 times a day in order to protect their bodies from oversweating or from skin diseases. They also spray water on their beds and pillows to produce a little coolness, but that quickly fades away. Prisoners are allowed one small fan in each room, but this only moves the hot air around and doesn't reach the four corners of the room. Prison authorities are also known to cut off electricity from the cells during the day, meaning prisoners cannot even use the fan. Meanwhile, the hot plate used for cooking and heating food makes the cells more stuffy. As a result, some prisoners avoid using it during the summer, eating cold, canned food instead, according to Abu Asab. He said, in our normal situation outside the prison, we can't think, work, sleep or live in general if we don't have an air conditioner. So you can imagine what being deprived of cooling does to prisoners who are already suffering from harsh conditions and unfair sentences. Bayan Faroun, 28, was detained for 40 months in the Daimon prison located near the coastal city of Haifa and describes the detention facility, which holds 30 female Palestinian prisoners, as an oven. She said, "We shared one fan that was useless. And unfortunately, our prison conditions were more difficult than the rest of the prisoners, as the shower was located outside our section and we were only allowed to use it once a day at hours determined by the prison administration. Meanwhile, the only refrigerator for the prisoners was located outside their section and was closed daily from 6 p.m. to 7 a.m., depriving prisoners of access to cold food and drinks." Faroun said, "Because of the intense heat and our need for cold water, we used to bring in the vegetable box and turn it into a small refrigerator by placing water bottles inside, which we had previously frozen, and cool anything we wanted by placing it on top of the bottles. But after a few hours, it becomes warm again." Many female prisoners suffer from bullet wounds sustained during their arrest that sting in the heat. However, Isra Jabis from Al-Quds suffers from deep burns that cover 50% of her body and make the high summer temperatures particularly agonizing. The vehicle she was traveling in exploded just before she was arrested in 2015 for allegedly attempting to carry out an operation against the Zionist regime forces. Faroun said Jabis, with whom she shared a prison section, could sometimes be found crying from pain caused by the effect the heat has on her burnt skin. Jabis also experienced shortness of breath that got worse as the humidity increased in the prison, which, like many others, lacks cooling and ventilation. There are more than 5,000 Palestinians currently incarcerated in Zionist regime prisons. While some of these may be in hotter locations than others, all are exposed to uncomfortable temperatures. Amina Altavil, a researcher at the Palestine Center for Prisoner Studies, told Middle East Eye that the cells holding Palestinian prisoners are closed from all sides with no proper ventilation, while the fans inside the rooms only circulate hot air. The prisoners who suffer most from the heat are detained in prisons located in particularly extreme locations, Naqab, Rimmon, Nafha, and Eshel, in the occupied territories south. These hold nearly half of the total number of Palestinian prisoners. The detainees have described these locations as a piece of hell, where their bodies roast in the intense heat. Tawil said several cases of heat stroke, fainting, and shortness of breath have been recorded this year, adding that the conditions are dangerous for ill prisoners who already don't have access to adequate medical care. She added, instead of helping them, the prison administration sometimes punishes the prisoners by confiscating the fans. Last July, the Naqab desert saw temperatures reach 50 degrees Celsius, making it impossible for prisoners to go out into the prison yards. Meanwhile, the sweltering heat also brings out poisonous reptiles, insects, and scorpions, which can easily find their way into prison sections, further endangering the lives of prisoners, said Tawil. But as summer ends, Palestinian prisoners are forced to begin preparing for the winter season, which brings with it another challenge, the cold, alongside the continuing pressure applied by the Zionist regime prison authorities, whatever the season. According to Palestine Chronicle, over 600 Palestinian prisoners suffer from different kinds of diseases. 126 of them suffer from chronic diseases, including 26 who have been diagnosed with cancer, according to the Prisoners Affairs Authority. Unfortunately, many cancer-stricken patients have already lost their lives in Israeli regime jails throughout the years. Aside from cancer, the bad living conditions in Israeli regime prisons are conducive to the spread of various diseases. Prisoners only eat canned food. Their cells lack hygiene, and the prisons are overcrowded. In many cases, Palestinian prisoners do not declare that they are sick because of the long procedures to receive treatment and the deliberate policy of medical negligence implemented by Israeli regime authorities. Additionally, the Zionist regime regularly denies prisoners the right to be transported to hospitals or medical institutions under the pretext of overcrowding.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Yemen is marking the ninth anniversary of the September 21 revolution. In 2014, the people of Yemen led a popular uprising against the Saudi-backed unpopular regime of Abd Rabbah Mansur Hadi. In the meantime, Yemen has endured the worst Saudi onslaught backed by the U.S. on the country war which has temporarily stopped, but not over yet, due to ongoing talks with the Saudi side. Will this revolution bear the fruits of the hardships that the people in Yemen endured? Will outside interference, like from the U.S., prevent this from happening? Ultimately, will there be a peace deal? Just a few of the angles we'll be looking at in this edition of the program. First, let me introduce our guest. Hussein Al-Bukhaiti, activist and political commentator, joins us from Sana'a. Also joining us is Saab Shah, author and West Asia expert, who joins us from Belfast. Welcome to you both. I'll start with you, Hussein Al-Bukhaiti. So it's been a long time now, taking a look back at what has happened here. One of the things that I'd like to get your idea on was back in 2012, if I may test your memory, you had elections that happened there, and you had people that came out to vote. But the problem was that this was a one-man election. You only had, and it's quite incredible, Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi as the only candidate that came out. And, of course, we know if there's one candidate, who's going to win. I think the people of Yemen obviously must have lost trust, if there was any left, in that process. Can you tell us what your thoughts were, given what happened back then?
Yeah, that's exactly what happened. This actually was made up by the Saudi, the so-called the Gulf Initiative, which has insisted that Yemenis must have that national dialogue. And then there was that election because Abd Rabbo Mansour Hadi, his term has ended at that time. So they said they will extend his term for 1 year. And Ansarullah have actually agreed to that at that time. But after this year was ended, they have done, as you say, one-man election. And he actually obviously has won that election. And this show you that what the Saudi actually claim that they are protecting the so-called Yemeni legitimacy is all lies. And we know now that Saudi Arabia has actually put the former President Hadi under house arrest for almost 1 year and a half or 2 years. We don't know what's happening with him. That's actually a clear message to everybody, especially people in Yemen who are fighting in the side of Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates. They must they must know that Saudi and United Arab Emirates actually they just want Yemen to be divided, and they just want the situation to get worse in Yemen. But on the other side, they want as well to have peace, not only in Yemen, not on Yemen, but to avoid any attack or any ballistic missiles or drone attack against Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates.
All right, so you had, Saab Shah, the elections, and then you had Yemen's Ansarullah that moved in took over the state institution in Sana'a and basically wanted to have a democratically elected institution overall to be there. But then you had the war that broke out. Tell us the reason why you had Saudi Arabia, which is a coalition at that point, backed by the United States, leading this war. What reasons did they have behind doing that?
The Saudi war of aggression were largely supported logistically and politically as well, and even military and training, and then refueling even the air fighters sorties in disguise of Yemen by the United States of America and other. Even nearly 80% of the equipment used in that aggression were supplied by the United States of America. And all the info and all the logistics as well. And 20% came from other countries like the United States, United Kingdom, France, Germany. Yemen lies in a very strategic position. This is controls the Arabian Sea and controls Bab al-Mandab, which enters the Red Sea, which is over 40% of the energy, which oil and gas goes to the world, and especially the West from there through the Suez Canal. We know anything comes from the Gulf states going in there. And we know as well why the United Arab Emirates went straight and occupied Aden and took over the port, not even to develop it, to make sure it will never functions and work, and to make sure all the business stays in Jabal bin Ali and Dubai. In history, we know that the British used to run most of their empire from Aden, from India to Australia. That used to be Aden, which the third largest port in the world, which is give the British that immense control and power. So the United States of America today do want to see an independent, sovereign Yemen state who doesn't obey the United States of America's orders or directions or its puppets in Saudi Arabia. So that's why they want to control Yemen, to make sure the whole strategic area is still under control of Zionist Western powers. And Saudi Arabia was acting in their behalf to further that agenda.
All right, so Hussein Al-Bugheiti, tell us how much the U.S. interfered in Yemen's affairs, what kind of role and how much of a role it played, which was a destructive one when it came to Yemen.
I mean, it was clearly, as an example, in the first year of the war against Yemen, we remember that before Saudi or the so-called Hadi government has moved the central bank from Sana'a to Aden. Sana'a government at that time used to pay the salary. Like 2 years and a half after the start of the war, till mid-2018. And then in some of the talks that was held in Muscat and in Oman, and there was as well the former U.S. ambassador to Yemen, he has actually at that time threatened the Sana'a delegation in Muscat that they will cut the salaries and as well they will move the central bank. And this is actually what happened since 2018. The Yemen income from gas and oil revenue has been sold out. The money actually Saudi is using that money in their war effort. They think that because there will be a pressure from Yemeni population against Saudi Arabia, especially not paying the salaries of Yemeni public sector. But what's happening actually is exactly the opposite. And this show you that the United States was actually planning from the beginning to stop those salaries. And as well, when the war was declared, it was declared from Washington by the ambassador of Saudi Arabia at that time. And it's really, really funny that a war is declared against a country, declare a war against another country from a third country. And soon after that declaration from Saudi ambassador in Washington, United States White House has released a statement saying that they will support that war against Yemen. And we've seen what the United States have actually done. They have struck the largest deal of weapon sales to Saudi Arabia and in the history of the United States to Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates during this war. And this actually shows that United States actually is well involved in this war. And if it was not to the United States, especially to the refueling planes that was refueling Saudi Arabia fighter jet across Yemen, Saudi Arabia actually will not be able to continue this war for more than a year. And this exactly shows that the United States is actually willing to divide Yemen. They are willing to keep the situation in Yemen and the humanitarian disaster, one of the largest man-made disaster in the history of the world. And we've seen many outbreak of illness in Yemen. And I believe that if the Saudi Arabia actually, they might be actually willing to stop their war, because we've seen so many attacks against Saudi Arabia, but because actually the decision is in the hand of the United States.
All right, so you have this war that started, and many people forget, Saab Shah, as our guests have reminded us, that it was actually announced by the U.S., which is quite unprecedented. And then as the war went on, you saw country after country dropping out of this war. There was a number of countries that were in support of this war and were part of the coalition. They continued to drop out until only Saudi Arabia and the UAE, along with the backing from the U.S., were left. But they weren't able to win the war. And they were so desperate at one point that even al-Qaeda, as a leader of Yemen's Ansarullah resistance movement, stated that the U.S. was using al-Qaeda terrorists not only to create divisions within Yemen, but to advance its agenda on the ground in order to beat the Ansarullah fighters, which they ultimately weren't. Why were they not able to beat the Ansarullah fighters, do you think?
Let's remember one fact, that the when the Saudis used Takfiri groups and the Americans engineered that actually for them on the ground, that's meant to get Yemen divided amongst tribes and amongst regions, so Yemenis can fight each other. And this is where they were bidden, as the Houthi himself said today. But Yemeni people, as we seen today when they were celebrating the 9th anniversary of the September 21st revolution, they showed a huge military parade in Al-Sab'een Square in Sana'a. During the parade, they displayed homemade vehicles, military boats loaded with heavy machine guns, drones, or range of missiles. This all made at home, and while flying in the skies, a war fighter jet and helicopters. That is muscles being flexed in the face of the Saudis. This is a victorious people who has developed their indigenous military industries. And as your guest alluded to, this weapons reach the heart of Saudi Arabia in Aramco, which is the nerve center of all life in Saudi Arabia, and reach United Arab Emirates, Abu Dhabi. So these two countries who's left in the coalition, they have interest. One of them, the Emiratis, as I said, they wanted to control the south of Yemen with the help of the Zionist entity. And the Saudis is still under orders of the United States of America to stay the foot in Yemen, because the Americans don't want Yemeni independent state sovereign who doesn't obey the orders of the United States of America to run that strategic country. Right. And the Saudis as well wanted to take a huge chunk from Yemen and its wealth as well.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Now we have enough reminiscing, I guess, about what was in the past. So now we're looking at what's happening currently. And it was in April, Hossein Abu-Ghaiti, roughly when we saw the ceasefires take place. And we now are in the phase of talks that are happening between the two sides. But what's interesting was that you had the U.S. Special Envoy for Yemen, his name Tim Lenderking, who was very pessimistic about these talks. I mean, he came out and said, quote, "I don't expect a durable resolution, and we should not, to the nearly eight-year conflict in Yemen, to happen overnight." And he said it wasn't something that's going to actually lead to any peace at this point. Some took that to mean that the U.S. did not want for peace to prevail, for there to be a deal. Why was the U.S., or why is the U.S., against a peace deal to happen?
Of course, we know that all United States policy in our region or in other areas across the world, it depends on chaos in those country. As an example, one of the main reasons that the United States actually was interfering in Yemen even before the Saudi United Arab Emirates coalition war is what they said is because their goal is to fight, as they say, terrorism. But if they really wanted to stop that, they can see that Sana'a government actually they are willing to fight terrorists, and actually they have been succeeded in clearing all areas is under the control of Sana'a government from all terrorism. But this really clearly that the United States, as you mentioned, with their special envoy to Yemen, which have clearly made it that the United States is not expecting any peace from this talk, because they are actually the one who is in control. But the Saudi Arabia, if they really wanted an advice, they should actually look what is in their favor, what's in their advantage. Their economy is actually, and especially the oil refinery, is under threat from attack from Sana'a. That's why they should take a serious step to stop that. And that's why we've seen in the latest 2 to 3 weeks, in the last 2 months, a Saudi delegation has visited Sana'a, and as well, Sana'a delegation has visited Saudi Arabia. And I believe that this is because Saudi Arabia knows that there might be an imminent attack against Saudi Arabia, especially after the celebration of Prophet Muhammad. And I would just add one more thing.
Sure.
That Saudi Arabia, and they have the so-called Vision 2030. That's why Mohammed bin Salman, if he want actually to put that vision, which is actually started at the beginning of the war on Yemen, to change Saudi Arabia economy, he should actually consider that he must stop this war. And one final thing, we all remember that Saudi ambassador to the United States, who has actually declared this war, have said in an interview that this war was planned with the USA 6 months before the start of the first airstrike. And this is clearly shows United States' interest in keeping chaos in Yemen.
Sure. Well, you know, what's interesting here, Sabshath, is this U.S. Special Envoy has also said that the preference here was for the war to actually continue, even as we speak. This is really the U.S. stance. And I want to ask from you, what he has stated is to advance the U.S. and Israeli anti-Iran crusade. Now, what is the deal there? I mean, is it because they want to keep Iran on check, or do they want to control this, as you mentioned, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, and the Bab el-Mandab Strait, the significance and importance that that has? They want to control that, but they can't do it with the Ansarullah movement in power. Is that the correct understanding or analysis there?
I really appreciate your question. It's a fantastic question. The United States of America invested heavily in this war and used all these puppets in the region to achieve, as I mentioned earlier on, to help Saudis to take a chunk, which is Hadramaut of Yemen, and to annex it. From Hadramaut, the Saudis plan to put an oil like a pipe to reach the Arabian Sea in there, which is will help Saudi Arabia to export 90% of its oil through that direction, which is a Strait of Hormuz will be absolute for the Saudis. And here with the United States of America's strategic plan is to stagnate Iran through the Strait of Hormuz. So the Saudis' oil can go through Yemen, exported. The Emiratis from Fujairah and that areas. So the only country will be in difficulties exporting its oil to the international market will be Iran. This is one major point in the whole of war on Yemen. And the other one is to make the Israeli regime is supreme in the region. As they try to build bases in Socotra and taking control in the little islands near Bab el-Mandab, so they can control all the trade and the movement, maritime movement in that area. So the whole thing is about hegemony and total control for the United States of America and Israel, and more and more besiege and stagnation for Iran.
Sure. Well, Hossein Boukhaiti, we find ourselves in a very interesting place when it comes to Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia, as you are very well aware, its jewel, Aramco, was targeted by the Ansarullah movement, and they did it so well and on a number of occasions. Many have said that Saudi Arabia expected the U.S. Under the basis that Iran was supplying, which is false. Iran has said, we're not supplying any type of military equipment to the Ansarullah. But Saudi Arabia expected the U.S. to attack Iran. But when it saw that did not happen, hence we're looking now at a landscape where Saudi Arabia wants talks to reach some kind of conclusion. Is that a correct way of looking at it, given the fact that the U.S. doesn't want there to be a peace deal?
It could be right in some point, but Saudi Arabia, if they are really seeking some conclusion or result in stopping the war and stopping attack against Saudi Arabia, they know the only way, as Sana'a have said, is that the Saudi will stop further war effort against Yemen, will stop this aggression, lift the blockade, and withdraw all military personnel that they are not Yemeni, either from United States or United Arab Emirates. And we've seen that this so-called that weapons, or Iran supplying weapons, Saudi Arabia has been closing the airport and the port for many, many years. They have been bombing a small fishing boat. It is hard, actually, to get medicine into Yemen, and they show you how false their claim that Yemen is actually getting weapons from Iran. But on the other hand, let's say what they said is right. Yemen have the right to buy weapons from anywhere in the world to protect themselves. Saudi Arabia, they are not planting the F-16 or the Patriot or other military equipment in their field. They are actually buying those weapons directly from United States, and they are getting direct help and direct support from United States and UK and other countries. But it has been clearly that the main goal or is actually behind this war is United States, UK, and Israel. We've seen that the United Arab Emirates is trying to separate Yemen. They are building bases in Bab al-Mandab Strait and as well in Socotra Island, because I think that, and I'm sure that the United States knows that they cannot actually launch any war against Iran, or maybe there will be a future war or any clashes with China. That's why they want actually to secure the Red Sea. They don't want any country there that's anti-United States policy in the region.
Thank you for that. Last question to you, Sopshop, which I have to ask. You have 5 days of talks that have been reported to be very positive between the two sides. How much of a chance do you give these peace talks to actually yield results? In 1 minute, please.
I think the Saudis start to shift their position for the Yemenis' demands after the Omani mediator put more pressure on them, because refusing the salary issue and the humanitarian issues for Yemenis, it means back to square one, which is back to war, which is the Yemeni Houthi movement promised massive escalation. And that is, if you go to square one, it means defeat to the Saudis. The other point which I want to make very clear in here, and I hope my friends in Yemen get it, the Saudis in their statement lately took a negotiation talking about themselves as the mediator. They are not the mediator, of course. They are the leading force of this war of aggression. But they're using this terminology to try to escape from reconstruction of Yemen and the course of legal and reparation.